Hello and welcome back to our introduction to information systems. And you are over halfway done. We are in week 7 officially. And we're going to be asking the question and answering the question today, does IT even matter? And we started talking about this in module 1, but we're going to circle back and really give it some due diligence today. But first, I would love to, as usual, start us off in prayer. So if you would like to pray with me. Dear Heavenly Father, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to learn together. I'd like to thank you for, we've come to you for wisdom as we are trying to learn new things, for bravery of getting courage up to take a chance and take a course and learn something new. And please bless every student who takes that leap of faith and is going where they feel called, and we just appreciate so much that opportunity that they're able to learn new skills and advance in their families and their careers to be able to serve you even better. So thank you, and in your heavenly name we pray. Amen. Week 7. Let's jump right in. We're going to put up here, does IT even matter? And of course, we are talking back to Carr's argument in the Harvard Business Review of does IT matter? That is one of the supplemental readings that I would highly recommend you take a look at. And he says, actually, his article in the Harvard publication was IT does not matter. And so we're going to take a look at that. The learning objectives for this, as we are wrapping up the day today and moving on to module 8, we hope that you'll be able to define that productivity paradox and explain the current thinking on what you think of the productivity paradox. And we're going to jump into that in just a moment. Again, we're going to evaluate Carr's argument. We're going to describe the components of competitive advantage. And this is where I think this course really starts to get fun when we talk about how we've been learning about these tools and all the components that make up an information system. And now we get to actually talk about how they are useful to make a competitive advantage for your organization. And then we're going to describe information systems that provide businesses. So we're going to talk about what makes a competitive advantage and then how information systems play into those advantages and what you can do to make your organizations even stronger. So we're going to jump into that productivity paradox. All right, so this is in 1991, and the paradox was studying what should the investment be in IT, and productivity, is it worth it? If investing heavily in your resources and your time and your treasure into IT, does it really pay off in productivity? And the studies that were realized by this paradox was they were not realized at all, that these gains that they expected to see by implementing these IT strategies, they just weren't paying off in productivity. There we go. Hello again. And so why was that the case, that the productivity paradox didn't come out in a positive direction? And so we're going to talk about that mismeasurement of outputs and inputs. Was there really an accurate measurement going on during these studies? Were there lags due to learning the new systems and the technology and adjusting and training, redistribution and dissipation of profits, and then mismanagement of information and the technology itself? So this was done. And again, like we said, 1991. And my question to you would be to really stop and think, if this was done today, and the baseline being different, and not having to account for all of the ways that we have to, you know, adjust to these new IT protocols, a lot of us are starting with that baseline of having IT be part of our daily organizations and our daily lives. If we were to have the study done today, do you think there would be the same findings on if productivity was really increased with IT. Maybe, maybe not. Something for you definitely to think about. Nicholas Carr in the Harvard Business Review, again, now this is bumped up to 2003. He did write that article, IT Doesn't Matter, which is in the resources, the extra readings for you. So IT is really less of a differentiator because it's so widespread at this point. If your organization is investing heavily in IT, that's great. So is everybody else. It's not really that differentiator that's going to give your organization a competitive advantage anymore. It really is kind of par for the course that you would be investing in some of these IT tools. It's also so readily available, and the software is so easily copied that, you know, it's not really that new tools don't really give companies that sustained competitive advantage that they used to because they're copy and pasted everywhere. It's the canal street of the organizations that you can go and pick whatever software suite you want, whether that's a true copy, whether that's an official license or not, but all organizations are really benefiting from these tools. So IT, you need to find another way other than IT for some of these differentiators that we're going to be talking about. So what Carr suggested was that technology is a commodity and it should be managed like one. That you need to wait until it's cost effective to adopt some of these IT things. When a technology is brand new and almost at that brink of being cost prohibitive, we want to make sure, you know, waiting until it's at a low cost point will definitely make those gains more realistic for you and your organization. So not just low cost, we also want to make sure it's low risk so that you adopt the IT solution slowly so other companies can take those high risk and try out a new technology and change their whole organization overnight. And you can kind of sit back and watch what happens and have a case study before your eyes instead of jumping there yourself, of going the low-risk approach and going slowly to adopt some of these new IT tools. IT should operate as a utility in a company. Good service with minimal downtime. So one of those things, your company has electricity. And your company likely has a water connection. Your company should have IT in that same vein of having those standards of good service and maintenance with minimal downtime to make sure that these investments that you are making are going to be paying off and make IT actually worth it. Okay. We're going back to Harvard again. So this is Michael Porter of Harvard, and talking about competitive strategy. So in the late 70s, Michael Porter developed three models to help us think about strategy when it comes to our businesses and organizations on an enterprise level. The five force model, the value chain, and the generic strategies. We're going to look at several models he developed, including that five force, the value chain, and generic strategies in just a moment. So when we look at competitive advantage and through the lens of Porter, we're going to be looking at creating and sustaining superior performance. So not just doing well, but sustaining that high level of performance for your organization and having people notice and choose you over someone else because of this high level of superior performance. So when your organization can sustain profits that exceed the average for the industry, that's how you know you've got the competitive advantage. So in other words, you know, when you're killing it compared to your peers, you've got the competitive advantage. Example, I was going to write Google's strategy, but I forgot the word strategy, so this should just say Google. was an early adapter. I think Apple would also be sustaining that competitive advantage. Surely you can think of others. that are doing something that sets them apart to have superior performance over time on a trending level that that just keep that superior performance on top. So not just creating it, but the sustaining is the part that really will keep that long-lasting competitive advantage and keep you, you know, competitive in the field with your peers. There's only, if we look at the market and you look at who your target market is, for customers or clients or consumers or users or whatever the case may be for your particular enterprise or organization, you know, the pie is, let's say the pie is this big. It's not going to get any bigger. How many pieces of that pie is your organization going to get? Because this is how many users there are total. So how big of a piece is your pie going to be? And that's your competitive advantage. So we're going to move forward with Porter, with one of Porter's strategies. We're going to start with Porter's generic strategies. And again, these are generic in terms of a strategy to keep yourself competitive. So offer the lowest prices possible. So cost is a very generic strategy to keep that competitive advantage by having the lowest price. And we know that just because you have the lowest price, that's not the only thing you're communicating, right? If you are shopping for something and there's one product that is significantly lower cost than everything else, you could probably draw some other inferences there too in terms of what the quality might be of that product if it is significantly lower cost than others. You might sell a lot, but your target market might change, and you might be now appealing to a different audience than you did before. So you want to make sure that you're kind of on top of that. Other than cost, we want to talk about differentiation. And this is something very unique, a product or a service that you're offering that's different. It offers a unique value that people can't easily get somewhere else. They're going to come to you because you're different. Maybe it's your packaging. Maybe it's your customer services doing something that others aren't. You're offering some type of hook that's different that's going to have someone choose you over your competitors. And then there's focus. Maybe it's that you are super wide focus and you're focusing on the entire industry and you do it all, and that is appealing to that customer base. Or maybe it's you're going to get that advantage because you are extremely narrowly focused and you're not serving the entire industry. You're serving this one small market segment, but you're doing it really well and you are dialed in and you know exactly what they want and you're giving it to them. So that focus is going to be another one of Porter's generic strategies. And we're going to look here at that strategic advantage and competitive scope of just putting those into quadrants for you for these generic strategies. So we've got overall cost is going to be obviously up there in the corner of the lowest cost position, and that's for the whole industry. And then for a tiny segment, it's going to be the cost focus as well. Differentiation and then differentiation focus, again, as we get focused on a one particular market segment. So that is for cost. Oh, there we go. So now we have, there we go. I got them all. Here's some examples of organizations that are using these. So being different industry-wide, we're going to go with Samsung Galaxy. Being the lowest cost position industry-wide, we're going to go with Walmart. Being unique, having that unique perception by the customer in one tiny segment, we're going to call that differentiation focus REI. We know exactly who their customers are. They're not selling to everyone, and they're focusing on people who are interested in doing one type of thing. There's outdoor activities. They're very specific in what they are focusing on, and their customers perceive them as unique. That is their competitive advantage there, just like Walmart's is the low cost for the entire industry. And then that focusing on a particular segment, but then also trying to be the lowest cost in that particular segment would be Big Five. So So hopefully these are some examples that might help you kind of look through Porter's generic strategies. And next we're going to move on to Porter's value chain. Okay, so we're going to look at, I know there's a lot going on here. We're not going to go through every word of this slide, but this is to give you the value chain analysis for manufacturing firms. So we're going to look at the infrastructure for the firm, looking through the administrative roles, the management, the accounting, finance, strategic planning, what the infrastructure is for the firms. And then we're looking at HR, how they get employees, how they train and retain and recruit. We're going to look at the technology development, so the research and development, the process improvement that we have, the procurement. How are we going to purchase raw materials, machines, supplies, all of those things? And then if we look down at the bottom of those primary activities, we're not going to go through each one of them right now, but those kind of those primary activities are going to inform the chain that is the value chain analysis. So the next slide, we're going to see some of those inbound logistics and operations. We're going to talk about that bottom row, so we're not going to go into it right now. But once we look at that margin on the right-hand side, it takes into account everything from our firm infrastructure down to those specific primary activities, like our inbound logistics, which is things like our raw materials that are brought into the company to work with and working with outside vendors to get those prepared for what we're manufacturing. Our operations, which is any part of the business that converts raw materials into our finished products and services. How we operate, how we get that done, how we go from raw materials to a widget at the end of the day. And then our outbound logistics is, so now we've made the widgets, now how do we get them to the customers? Or if we have a service that we're providing, how are we going to get that good and those services out to our target market who's using us for one of or more of our competitive advantage reasons. So this value chain starts with these primary activities, and then we go up the chain here. The sales and marketing, our entire buyers to purchase products and service. Sales and marketing is pretty self-explanatory. Our service, so if someone has a problem, if a customer has a problem, if they have a question about any of our, just offering support. So otherwise, if you don't have this in place in the value chain, you're going to have a gap where you're going to be pulling people from doing other tasks that are really necessary for them to be competitive. And we want to make sure that we have people who are specifically there to take care of those questions and problems that might arise. Once we get up to that firm infrastructure, this is what we talked about, all those organizational functions supporting the business. Your technology department, your human resources, how all of those things work together. And then finally, we've got the technology development, which is advances and innovations adopted to add value to the company. And then procurement of just purchasing our raw materials. So I know that was a lot to say, but again, this is what the finished product would look like. So when we use that value model in a CRM, we're going to be looking again at those primary activities at the bottom, and then those things across the side are going to be our support activities. Those things at the top, those support activities, are going to be our enterprise resource planning, ERP. And we talked heavily about ERP in the software module. This is going to be the automation and kind of the guts of your organization on how you manage the day-to-day operations and how you're going to make sure that you are prepared for what you need to purchase and when things get shipped out and when a customer makes an order, it then triggers another process, which puts manufacturing into place, which then triggers another process to have shipping and quality control into place. All of those triggers that happen as part of our ERP, our enterprise resource planning, to make sure that your organization has what it needs, where it needs it, when it needs it. So those are going to be those support activities at the top with our, you know, Michael Porter's way that he talked about that strategic focus was to be that those activities happening at the top will then turn into support activities once the chain is set, that the primary activities at the bottom are going to inform those at the top. So the supply chain management are going to be those inbound and operations that we talked about with what we're buying and how we put the thing together, those supply chain. Do we have what we need to get it done? And then our customer relationship management, our CRM, that's going to be the outbound, the marketing, the service, how we are going to communicate with those customers once they have decided to purchase our goods or services, kind of how that all works together. Sounds really overwhelming if we did not have these IT tools that could help us keep it all together. Because as we were just saying, these events don't happen in a vacuum. These events trigger other events. So there is a system in place with our IT department that is going to automatically order materials we need and make sure that they arrive at the right place for the right person who needs it to build whatever product it is or whatever service you're providing, which will then, again, trigger all of those things to get them outbound and to market to our target market and to advertise and pricing at the right point with dynamic pricing to make sure we're competitive, and then shipping it out and then having the service agreements at the end and making sure our customers are happy. All of those things are part of our CRM, our customer relationship management. So these things all work together. The ERP, the supply chain, and the CRM, they all work together as part of this value chain model. So you really need strength in every area of that chain. And it's a lot to unpack here. it is one of, when we talk about the generic strategies from Porter, those were a little less complex. This value chain model is a little more complex. And the next one that we're going to do is Porter's 5-Force model. We're going to talk about that in just a second. Okay. So at the center of this model is an intra-industry rivalry or a competition within the industry. So we see, how competitive is the market? Think about Mickey D's. If you've ever been to McDonald's, how many other fast food chains are in the market competing with you? There's Burger King, there's Wendy's, there's In-N-Out, there's all these places where you can go get a burger. So how does McDonald's compete? Right? It's a very competitive marketplace, and they need to distinguish themselves either with higher quality stuff or, get back here. Here we go. They need to distinguish themselves with either higher quality or lower cost of service or being different, like we talked about, and being totally unique. So with McDonald's, they offer really fast food at a very reasonable price. So that's kind of their hook. It's people are on the go. They have kids in the car. They want a Happy Meal. They want it fast. They don't want to pay a lot of money. That's where you go there. So the next competitive force is the threat of new entrants. So we look up at the top of this 5-Force model. So how many companies are seeking to break into this industry? So when talking about fast food, are there lots of people that are trying to be the next Wendy's or whatever the case is, whatever fast food you like, the next McDonald's? And probably not a lot, because of the cost that it would really have to compete with these big established fast food giants. That would just be cost prohibitive to compete in that marketplace. So this threat of new entrants is going to be relatively low for this one. So although in the very the very center, that industry rivalry, is very strong with some key players, that threat of new entrants is relatively low. The third competitive force is that threat of substitute products. That's going to be down at the bottom. And this means that other places your customers might go and go get what you offer. So let's say there's a Panera Bread, a Taco Bell, and a pizza place. All of those regular restaurants could be substitutes for what McDonald's is offering. So companies need to consider those, even though they're not directly selling fast food hamburgers, they're also competitors. So you can think about competitive pricing and features that would make people choose that fast food hamburger from McDonald's over things like other choices like Panera Bread, Taco Bell, pizza, whatever. So the fourth one, so when it comes to food, that threat of substitute products could be relatively high depending on the price point. If you had McDonald's in mind because you wanted something off the dollar value meal, that might be where you're going no matter what. If you have an open mind and you want something fast but it doesn't have to be burgers, now we have a whole new can of worms. So that one could be relatively high. We're going to look at the fourth force, and this is for bargaining power of buyers. In the case of McDonald's, that means you and me. So how are we going to bargain? We have a choice on what we eat, and there's lots of fast food restaurants that we could go to. So our bargaining power is really high here. We could choose something else. So I think, you know, voting with your wallet is a very powerful way to make your preferences known when you are deciding what to buy or what not to buy. Our bargaining power is very high. If the line's too long at McDonald's and the place next door is giving away food, or, you know, if the line is really short, we can go across the street and eat there instead. That bargaining power of buyers on the right-hand side is very strong with our example of fast food hamburgers. Once we get into more really specific industries, a lot of times there is no bargaining power. This one would be very low in terms of if you want something that the price is what it is and you don't really have other options, your bargaining power is severely damaged and you pay whatever it is. A lot of times what I'm thinking of now is right now we are experiencing a very rapid and high increase in gasoline prices. And so we don't have a lot of bargaining power as buyers for that right now. Because you know what? We need it. If we can't dig a hole and get it ourselves, we can't go across the street and get it somewhere cheaper, because we can't. So the bargaining power of buyers really goes down in this scenario. However, on the bottom, if we look at that threat of substitute products again, there are a lot of people saying, you know what, I'm going electric at this point. And choosing a substitute instead of a gasoline-powered vehicle to get around it that way. We do have one last force, the fifth force that we're going to talk about here, is the bargaining power of suppliers. And that's the companies that support the products and services that lead to you getting the gasoline. Let's go back to the fast food example. So all the companies that come together that lead you to getting your Whopper. It's not a Whopper at McDonald's, but a Big Mac. So whatever companies are supporting that. So the beef vendor and the bread people who sell the buns and the people who sell uniforms to McDonald's for their employees and the cleaning supplies and the insurance companies that provide the health care to those employees and all of those things that go together. The people who sell the grease for the fryer and all those things that come together so that you can get a wrapped up sandwich. What happens, you know, they make McDonald's run. So if those companies that sell beef become really scarce, like only two companies you can buy beef from, then that power, that supplier power is really high. They can charge whatever they want, and they can make, you know, their deals aren't going to be as competitive. That supplier power would be really high. They can raise their price. McDonald's is going to have to pay it because you can't make hamburgers without beef. On the other hand, the uniform manufacturer, let's say they decide to increase their price by a lot, and McDonald's can just switch to a different supplier. They're not going to lose a lot of business. You buying a hamburger, you don't care what company is supplying the McDonald's uniforms. So that would be a very low bargaining power for those suppliers for uniforms. There is a sixth force. If we look up in the very, very corner, and that is going to be government regulation. And so when we talk about government regulation, this is going to be if there are regulations that come into place, whether you already have your strategy in place or not, this is going to be something that also impacts the way you do business. And a lot of times this is going to be another one where you don't really have a lot of bargaining power here, where you have to, there are regulations that will come into place and you need to meet them. So that is a sixth competitive force, but we are going to focus on the five forces right here first. And we just discussed these. I won't go through in depth again with these five forces because I think you've got it here. Okay, entry barriers. So as we're talking about, if you want to get into an organization, we already talked about at McDonald's, it's not going to be a ton of new fast food joints. It's just cost prohibitive to be competitive on that scale with these giants that are already so well established. So creating that barrier to entry to would-be competitors is something that might be beneficial to an organization. For instance, there is a set number of liquor licenses in a certain area that can be. If you want to open up a brand new bar, you're going to need to have a liquor license, which is at a cost point because they are limited that might prohibit new entrants to joining the market. You know, if you want to be the next Amazon, probably good luck with that, right? Because there's no way that you could compete with the established branding and brand recognition and the infrastructure in place, the supply chain in place, the now decades of this infrastructure that is now a machine that is Amazon. You can't just enter the marketplace. There's just no way. The same way we're talking about with the fast food. Now, there's lots of other industries where those entry barriers are very low. For instance, let's say you want to start a yoga studio, and you're starting a yoga studio in a town where there's one other yoga studio. Why not? Why not hang a shingle and start your own organization, start your own business? Those barriers to entry are just, you know, the cost of the physical space to lease and some simple marketing. So when we talk about some of these industries, they're going to be much different in terms of its barrier to entry. Switching costs. This is going to be those costs of a consumer to switch to another product. We're just going to make it easy for our people to stick with us. We want to make them like us and stick with us, and we're going to do everything in our power, including all of our IT tools, to make sure that they don't go elsewhere. Maybe that's a loyalty program where you collect stamps or you collect points or you collect purchases, Sky Miles, you know, whatever that case may be. Maybe there's a contract that's in place that you have to use them for whatever the good or service is for a certain amount of time, or you have a membership that would be very cumbersome or tricky to cancel or change. So we want to make sure that once we've acquired that customer, sometimes it's very expensive, And we use a lot of our resources, our IT resources, our marketing, our money, our people, to acquire a customer. So once we've got them, we want to make sure that they're not switching, that we're keeping them. Okay, and here's in a nutshell, again, with the cost, the differentiation, and the focus, and then those five forces of Porter's: the entry barriers, the buyer power, supplier power, threats of substitutes, and the rivalry. And we're going to just look real quickly on, we're not going to go through each one of these squares, but I would recommend that you really, really do go through in the reading and see how the generic strategies do really interface with the five forces that were all implemented by Porter. Okay, so we've talked a lot about what is competitive advantage, and now we're going to talk about how we use our information systems for competitive advantage. So we know competitive advantage means we're killing it. We have a big piece of that pie. We have a bigger slice than maybe some of our peers do, that we're doing well financially as compared to them. So that's our competitive advantage. So how do we use IS, information systems, to achieve this? And that's going to be looking at our business process management systems. Control of processes gives competitive advantage because why? Once things are like a well-oiled machine, once there are processes in place, we know that that's a big job of information systems, is to get those processes in place. I am a Lean Six Sigma black belt, so I have a very strong place in my heart for looking at process development, process improvement, and information systems play a huge role when you're looking, if you're familiar with Lean Six Sigma, or if you're familiar at all with process improvement. We use a lot of information systems tools to achieve those high levels of performance and, just improving those systems and processes. We're going to look at electric data interchange. And that's going to be the automation of the value chain gets products to market quicker. So we're going to use those information systems of automation to get our stuff to the market faster than our competitors so that, we get picked. We want to get there first. It allows for integration of partners in the value chain so that we don't have to do everything in a vacuum or in a silo. Once those information systems and networks are in place, we can go ahead and integrate, and we can and have some partners. It'll allow for a flexible value chain because of automation. We can do things in like a just-in-time manner instead of being kind of stuck and married to a process that might be out of date or no longer appropriate. Aha! So we've got collaborative systems, so easier ways for people to collaborate in works and processes. So these might look familiar to you. These are ways that our people can collaborate to gain that competitive advantage. Google Drive, Microsoft SharePoint, WebEx, Lotus Notes, all of these collaboration tools that are information systems, that really do help for those collaborations. Next is that decision support systems. And this is going to be how we make decisions. It might be an algorithm that is in place automatically as part of your information system strategy that goes through and looks at purchases over time and adjusts price accordingly in a dynamic structure to make sure that you are remaining competitive with your pricing. Assisting with those decisions at all levels, semi-structured, we're going to be looking and analyzing that data that I was just talking about, looking at all those tiny pieces of data to make them information, to make them knowledge, to make them wisdom. And then internally, we're going to have centralized data that can give us opportunities for insight And then externally, our data sources can inform strategic decisions about your industry, what's going on, some trends, new technologies, all of those things. So I know that was a lot of information at you. And I'm so happy that you're sticking with me here. We're just going to go ahead and kind of give a summary here on what we talked about today. And that's going to be defining that productivity paradox. And I wish we were in a room together. I would love to ask you, what do you think? What do you think about that productivity paradox? Does IT and implementing IT and doing it well, does it really increase productivity? And I'm sure there's not a yes or a no answer. I'm sure this is on a spectrum, but I want to know your take and your organizations on how that works. So I know I wish we could sit together and talk about that. We evaluated Carr's argument and does IT matter? Why the data pointed at the time in 1993 to no, it does not matter, and how that might be different with a different baseline now of IT standards and expectations. We reviewed the components of competitive advantage. What makes an organization competitive? How do they compete? Whether that's by being different, whether that's by being the lowest cost, whether it's by being really broad or by being hyper-focused, how you can be competitively, how you can be competitive in your industry. And then we talked about how we can gain that competitive advantage using information systems and collaborating together and being first to market and having our supply chain locked in and having, you know, just-in-time ordering and all of those things that are going to keep us competitive, and they're all good things. So thank you for hanging in here with me and talking about does IT really matter? And we talked about all the reasons it does, and how we can stay competitive as an organization using some of these tools. So next week I am excited to talk with you about business processes. So we're going to jump right into that next week. Thank you. Have a blessed week, and I will see you soon. Thanks.